Welcome to Technology and the Arts, a bi-weekly podcast exploring the connections between the worlds of technology and art. In this installment, we'll hear from Greg Taylor, founder of Decoder Ring Theatre, a Toronto-based group that produces audio programs in the style of old-time radio shows. Plus, we'll discuss Indiana University's recent Arts Week event, which this year had the theme of technology and the arts. We'll also discuss Gizmodo's call for a boycott of the Recording Industry Association of America during March. And as usual, we'll share some interesting websites and online resources we've come across recently. We'll talk about all of this and more just ahead on Technology and the Arts for Wednesday, March 7th, 2007. Now here are your hosts, Brian Kelly and John Lemazny.
Welcome to another edition of the Technology and the Arts podcast. As always, Technology and the Arts seeks to explore the connections between technology and art and to establish a forum for discussing the impact technology has made on the human, creative process and on literature, music, and the visual and interactive arts.
And to let you know who we are, my name is Brian Kelly. I am a journalist by trade, amateur songwriter, musician, and science and technology enthusiast living in central New Jersey.
And I am John Lemazny, a father, artist, musician, poet, and technologist living in the Mid-Atlantic region.
Taking a look at what's on the palette for this podcast, in our In Perspective segment, we'll look at Arts Week 2007, which was recently held at Indiana University's main campus in Bloomington, Indiana. We love the theme of this year's event, technology and the arts. Naturally, there were some cool things going on there, which we'd like to talk about. Also, we'll discuss Gizmodo.com's call for a boycott of the Recording Industry Association of America throughout March. We'll also talk about BitTorrent's recently announced deal with a number of movie studios and television networks to sell TV shows and rent movies using BitTorrent's peer-to-peer file-sharing technology. And we'll look at the Pecha Kucha presentation format that has the potential to enliven otherwise boring presentations. And as usual, we'll share with you some helpful websites and online resources we have discovered lately. Among those we'll be talking about this week will be a really cool customization for your computer keyboard, an interesting video about Web 2.0, 12 podcasts for the creative class, and more. Then, in our dialogue segment, we'll hear from Greg Taylor, founder of Decoder Ring Theatre, a Toronto-based group that produces audio programs in the style of old-time radio shows. We talked at length about Decoder Ring Theatre in our January 24th podcast, and even included an excerpt from one of its shows, Red Panda Adventures No. 2, Night Patrol. However, we'll bring you up to speed on Decoder Ring Theatre just before we hear from Greg later in the show. But before we get into all that, John, it's good to see you again. How you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thanks. What have you been up to lately?
Well, some exciting things going on. I'm really getting pretty deep into Moodle. Moodle is a open source learning management system that's sort of a competitor to things like Sakai and Blackboard. And you can check out our installation of Moodle at Rider by visiting the techarts.wordpress.com website. There you'll be able to investigate some of our open learning courses, things like open source education and information about Creative Commons and some of the Center for Innovative Instruction sessions. We have a lot of materials there that support those sessions, so you might be interested in that. I do want to plug an upcoming presentation I'm giving, part of the Tuesday Technology Talks at the Princeton Public Library. That's going to be Tuesday, April 3rd at 7 p.m. I'm giving a presentation on extending Firefox, where I'll talk about 25 extensions that I use, my favorite 25 extensions that I use with Firefox. Firefox, in case you don't know, is an open source web browser. You should definitely find out what it is if you don't know what it is. And if you're interested, contact me. I'll be happy to tell you. I just wanted to thank Janie Herman at the Princeton Public Library for the opportunity to present, and I'm looking forward to it. Recently, I gave a presentation for NJEdge.net on DLAB. There's also links to that in our show notes.
What is DLAB?
I'm glad you asked. DLAB is a distance learning advisory group that's part of NJEdge, a consortium that Rider University belongs to. NJEdge.net is this group that we belong to sort of manage our larger network, our extranet network, and DLAB is one of the specialty groups that Rider is a part of. We meet to talk about distance learning topics, and I gave a presentation there on our installation of media.rider.edu, our open source technology-based streaming media server. And finally, I just want to mention that I have recently changed RSS feed readers. I'm currently using Google's Google Reader to read my RSS feeds, and if you see me in person, you'll notice the rings underneath my eyes. That's really why. I've been up for probably an extra 4 hours a day just reading RSS through Google's RSS feed reader, and it's a fantastic tool, but it's made my productivity go way down. How about you? What have you been up to?
Well, I've spent some time writing on the blog, the Technology and the Arts blog, about the recording industry, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. I also want to thank our subscribers, the subscribers to our podcast. As of Saturday, March 3rd, which is when we are recording this podcast, our feed stats, according to feedburner.com, say that we have had double-digit subscriber totals for each of the previous 13 days, starting Sunday, February 18th. That span includes a single-day subscription high of 21, fittingly enough, on February 21st. These numbers are very encouraging to us at this point of our podcast's lifespan. They're very modest numbers we're talking about, of course, but that count just includes those who have subscribed to the feed through an RSS reader, podcatcher, or iTunes. It also doesn't include those of you who may be listening through the embedded players at techarts.wordpress.com or through our MySpace site. So I just wanted to thank all of our subscribers and listeners. We know you are out there, so please send us some email or add some comments to our blog. We want to know what you like and what you don't like. Our goal is to inform and educate you about the connections between technology and art in a hopefully somewhat entertaining way. Let us know if we are doing a good job or not. Please be our critics. But now let's go to our In Perspective segment. This is where we look at recent headlines or hot topics, give a little background information on them, and then discuss them. John, what would you like to put in perspective for our listeners this week?
Well, in particular, I want to talk about the CC Host project at freshmeat.net. CC Host is a way for you to set up your own Creative Commons repository so that people could upload content, things like audio clips and video clips, photos for people who are visiting that site to use in mashups and mixes. So, for instance, you might be able to use a CC Host site at your own institution or company for people to create a community around Creative Commons. If you don't know what Creative Commons is, you definitely should look into it. Check out the links at our show notes.
By the way, our podcast is covered by a Creative Commons license, thanks to the good people at archive.org. So
absolutely.
Just want to point that out.
And if anybody wants to use our voices in any sort of mashups or mixes, please feel free to go ahead. Secondly, I'd like to talk about the steampunkworkshop.com's keyboard mod, where somebody took a IBM keyboard from like the 70s, and around the blogosphere, everybody's been talking about this great keyboard mod where a traditional typewriter with, you know, the round keys, the keys get taken off and put onto a keyboard from today, you know, this IBM keyboard from the 70s. And part of the reason why they chose this particular keyboard was because of the response that the keys gave. They gave a real sort of nice click when you tap them. And so with these nice keyboard keys from, I guess, the 1930s, these round keyboard keys, typewriter keys, on top of this IBM keyboard, it has a really steampunk style feel. If you don't know what steampunk is, it's sort of a meshing of futuristic style with turn of the century style. And those ideas sort of come together in this really fresh, techno, retro way.
It's a really cool look. Once you see the keyboard, it's really, really neat.
They pay a lot of attention to detail. Changethis.com is a collection site, a repository for manifestos. So if you're into revolution, go check that out.
We will be talking about a manifesto a little bit later on, just to let you know.
Another thing we want to talk about is this weird phenomenon in New York about stump upholstery, where this guy has sort of taken it on himself to go out and bring attention to stumps of trees that have been cut down by upholstering them, by putting a little bit of padding and a really sort of fancy upholstery job on the stump. And he wants to make it sort of like a movement. He wants you to go out and find stumps and upholster them too, to sort of bring people's attention to them. So without this widespread advertising of this through technology, it would be really hard for this movement to get going at all. But because he had a blog and he had these photos and they got passed out around the internet, you know, it's like all of a sudden I want to be a stump upholsterer. I definitely want to make everybody who's listening aware of the idea of Pecha Kucha. Pecha Kucha is a presentation format that forces a quick movement through a certain number of slides. That's 20 slides. Each of these 20 slides is put up for 20 seconds apiece. And so you end up with a presentation that's exactly 6 minutes and 40 seconds long. On our website, you'll be able to find a template that I've created in Open Document Presentation Format, or ODP. You can use openoffice.org in order to edit those. I've made this template so that you can very quickly get a Pecha Kucha presentation together. And the idea is that you get together with 14 other people in a night of presentations using this Pecha Kucha format, and you're all able to get a lot of ideas out there very quickly. The whole movement is really motivated by these presentations that go on and on and on, where there's a lot of speech and a lot of very small text on a lot of slides, where relatively simple idea can really get lost in all the details up on screen. Pecha Kucha forces the ideas to come out very quickly, almost in like a shotgun blast, and for people to start to absorb them, and then for another topic to come right afterwards. It's really great for artists because they can put up a lot of works in a short period of time. And then once the presenter goes back into the audience, you know, conversations can happen. But that might not happen in a longer presentation or more traditional presentation where, you know, somebody spends an hour giving 100 slides all with, you know, 15-point type. So Pecha Kucha, go check it out. A couple links you'll see on the Technology and the Arts blog are some culinary arts links. One is about open source Coca-Cola. It's not actually Coca-Cola, of course. It's open source cola called Open Cola, and it is applying open source ideas to food, to a combination of ingredients to create something that's pretty sophisticated, that is cola. On a much simpler scale, I wanted to talk about the idea of four-ingredient bread. I actually did some research, and right now at home, I have a couple loaves that are rising of this four-ingredient bread. It's really simple. It's just flour, salt, water, and yeast, and it's amazing. I'm going to put the recipe up on the blog. Finally, I want to talk about a video that's made its rounds in the last couple weeks on YouTube called The Machine is Using Us. It's a short presentation, 4 or 5 minutes, on the ideas represented in Web 2.0 technologies. It starts off with something as simple as writing on a page and ends up with the semantics of cascading style sheets. And it does it in such a way as anybody could understand it. It's really a beautiful video piece, and everybody should see it. Brian, how about you?
Well, the first thing I would like to talk about is Arts Week 2007 at Indiana University. Arts Week actually recently ended, but I figured we needed to talk about it considering that the theme for this year's event was technology and the arts. Unfortunately, I didn't find out about this event until it was too late, but that would have been a great event for us to cover and, you know, possibly talk to some of the people that were involved. But I just wanted to point it out. There was a link in the show notes. Hopefully, even though Arts Week is over, you can just take a look and see what types of events they had. One thing that I particularly found interesting was an exhibit called The Sound Garden. And The Sound Garden was a musical installation that explored the relationships between people, location, and music relative to technology. In this work, people who visited, either physically or through the website, listened to and tended the garden. Location, in this sense, included both physical and virtual spaces, and audio referred to manifestations of sound, silence, noise, and music. Now, I actually went on the Soundgarden site and contributed this old throwaway piece of music that I had worked on. It was a little techno piece that I tentatively called Transin. And I added it to the garden. I added the seed to the garden, and I listened to the Soundgarden through iTunes. And it was really cool. Sometimes I could hear like little pieces of my song coming through all these other noises that were being affected by the people that were there. I believe vibrations, temperature, all these things affected what sounds were being played. Kind of in a way how, you know, the Princeton Laptop Orchestra had used different controllers to control, you know, the sounds that were being generated by the laptops. It kind of had that similar feel to it. So it was really cool, though, that they had this web component that you could participate in this exhibit that was taking place in Bloomington, Indiana. So that was kind of cool. Another thing that I found that was interesting is jacksonpollock.org, and that is brought to you by artist Miltos Manitis and based on Splatter, a drawing study by Mike Migurski from stamen.com, which is available under a Creative Commons license. Look for a link to Splatter in the show notes, and you can download it if you like. At jacksonpollock.org, the browser window basically becomes a blank canvas, and you can use your cursor to simulate the drip or pouring technique made famous by Jackson Pollock. Clicking the mouse changes colors. It's just real fun to play with. And, John, you've been to that site, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, a friend of mine, Chris Spahn, made me aware of that site, and he said when he saw it, he thought of me, which I thought was a real compliment.
So, yeah, it's really cool. So just go to the show notes and visit that site. Another thing I've come across recently, FastCompany.com a few weeks ago put out a list of 12 podcasts, quote, designed for the eclectic tastes of the creative class, unquote. The podcasts that they chose covered topics of interest to artists, musicians, Web 2.0 workers, technologists. They even had one that was for the culinary arts, which John mentioned earlier, scientists, business leaders, business owners, even in humanitarians. You should really go check that out. If you want to listen to some podcasts and you're in one of those groups, just follow the link in the show notes for those podcasts. And another thing that just happened a couple of days ago was that BitTorrent has entered into agreements with some major movie studios and television networks to sell TV shows and rent movies through its technologies. They're going to be offering movie rentals from Warner Brothers, Paramount, 20th Century Fox, MGM, and Lionsgate, as well as a number of shows from Comedy Central, Fox TV, MTV, Nickelodeon, Spike, and VH1, among others. Co-founder Ashwin Navin told the Associated Press that he believes up to a third of current BitTorrent users would be willing to pay for legitimate content if it were available and affordable. Pricing will be roughly equivalent to similar services, with TV episodes coming in at $1.99 apiece and movie rentals ranging from $2.99 to $3.99. Rented movies must be watched within 24 hours after the user has first clicked the play button. However, note that I said rented movies. There are no movie downloads. Speculation is that the studios wanted to charge a price that the BitTorrent team was not comfortable charging its audience. They didn't think it would appeal to them. And there's also, of course, DRM restrictions. The movies and the TV shows will all be using Windows Media Digital Rights Management. The purchased TV shows and rented movies can only be viewed on the Windows platform also. So that means no Mac, no Linux. Mac and Linux users can download the content, but they need to be running Windows to watch it.
Although somebody might be able to hack together some sort of a wine combination, wine being the Windows emulator for Linux, and of course
there's Boot Camp for Mac OS.
Yeah, there are ways that you could do it. It's just unfortunate that they're not opening this up to other platforms.
So. My take is that, you know, it's no real innovation here. They're really not offering much that some of these other sites out there, really not doing anything different. Maybe they do have some more studios than some of these other sites going for them. But it's nice to see the movie studios give peer-to-peer file sharing a chance in this case. I think that's something the music industry failed to capitalize on when, you know, Napster was at its peak, and it's at least encouraging to see the movie studios trying to think a little bit differently and cooperating and making a deal with a peer-to-peer file sharing system instead of battling them at every turn.
One thing I wanted to mention here is that if you are not interested in looking at BitTorrent as a media downloading option, legitimate or otherwise, because you are a Netflix subscriber and you're waiting for your turn in the queue to get the Watch Now functionality that was announced recently. If you don't have it right now, that doesn't mean you can't get it right now. One little known idea is that you can actually go into the Netflix site, if you're a Netflix subscriber, go into the frequently asked questions and click on a link that says, how do I watch movies on my computer? When you click on that link, you will get the Watch Now functionality immediately, and you can begin using it right afterwards. So the kind of functionality that BitTorrent is offering, if you're a Netflix subscriber and you've been waiting for this feature, go click on the FAQ and get the functionality right now.
That is very interesting. And turning from movies to music, technology blog Gizmodo has announced plans to boycott the RIAA in March. The RIAA, of course, being the Recording Industry Association of America. And as most of you probably have heard, John and I have expressed our thoughts plenty of times on this podcast regarding the RIAA. And, you know, I've recently written extensively on the topic on our blog at techarts.wordpress.com. But I just wanted to spread the word about Gizmodo's call for this boycott during March and to make more people aware of the issues at hand. This is more than just a fight against digital rights management and the RIAA's unethical and possibly illegal legal tactics. There are other issues at stake. The boycott asks you to not buy music from the four major labels that fund the RIAA.
Consider it done.
Yeah, and you know, actually, when I saw this, I went and looked at my recent music purchases, and about 90% of them were on independent labels anyway. So I'm really not getting most of my music these days from the major record labels. I'm finding the independent labels are putting out much better product.
I haven't been really excited about what's coming out of RIAA-associated media producers anyway.
I mean, basically, Mike Doty, Ben Folds, thankfully they're not putting out new albums, you know, in March, because, you know, I'd have to make exceptions for them. But Ben Folds is playing in March, and I might go see him if things work out right.
That's allowed.
So I can support him that way, which is what this boycott, you know, says to do. And it says if you want to support those artists, go see them live, buy some merchandise, but don't give the record labels any money this month.
That's the way they're going to make the most money anyway. Go and see them live.
Right. They're not getting much from the record company, believe me. So please visit the links we have provided in the show notes for Gizmodo's posts about the boycott, including its anti-RIAA manifesto, which is very well-written, I thought. And also, please read my post, some more thoughts on the RIAA, on the technology and the arts blog. I just put that up a few days ago. Take the time to read the articles I've linked to from that post. They are very enlightening. There are pieces from three artists who work or have worked for the major labels, Courtney Love, Janis Ian, and Scott Albini. And none of them paint a very pretty picture of the mainstream record industry from an artist's perspective. These aren't my words. These are the words of people who know more about the industry than I ever will. So I put a lot of weight in what they have to say. So just know about that, and, you know, hopefully we can end this reign of terror from the Recording Industry Association of America.
Well, it's now time for our dialogue segment featuring conversations with those who work with art and technology on an everyday basis. And this week, we'll be hearing from Greg Taylor, the founder of and head writer for Dakota Ring Theater. Dakota Ring Theater is a theater company based in Toronto that produces audio programs in the style of old-time radio shows, which can be downloaded as podcasts or heard through arrangements with broadcast partners. Dakota Ring Theater offers two different programs, the Red Panda Adventures, chronicling the 1930s exploits of Canada's greatest superhero, which is inspired by classic radio series like The Shadow and The Green Hornet. The other, Blackjack Justice, is influenced by the classic tales of Gumshoe's Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade, and features the hard-boiled detective duo of Jack Justice and Trixie Dixon. If you want to know more about Dakota Ring Theater, visit them online at www.dakotaringtheater.com or click on the link in the show notes for this podcast. You can also go back and listen to the January 24th installment of the Technology and the Arts podcast to hear our initial discussion of the site and a 5.5-minute excerpt of the Red Panda Adventures, number 2, Night Patrol. Brian recently contacted Greg up in Toronto, and he took the time to do an interview for us. So let's take a listen to Brian's conversation with Greg Taylor right now.
This is Brian Kelly reporting for Technology and the Arts. As a fan of old-time radio shows, especially The Shadow, I was thrilled when I discovered Dakota Ring Theater. I had always felt podcasting was the perfect medium for ushering in a new era of audio dramas, and it is encouraging to see Dakota Ring Theater and many others bringing back that genre. I quickly became a fan of Decoder Ring Theater's two series, The Red Panda Adventures and Blackjack Justice, and decided to find out more about the ensemble. That led me to Greg Taylor, founder of Decoder Ring Theater and the man behind the mask and voice of the Red Panda. I sent Greg an email to see if he'd be interested in doing an interview for Technology and the Arts, and he graciously obliged. Greg started out by telling me a little bit about himself and his theatrical background.
I come from a small town in Ontario that you've never heard of at all. oddly enough, for a guy my age, I grew up listening to the 60 and 70-year-old radio programs that inspired our shows. There was a station out of Toronto that would play old-time radio shows on Sunday nights after a comedy show that I would listen to. So I was hooked very young. In those days, it was much harder to get your hands on recordings or really do any kind of exhaustive research. The digital revolution still being a ways off. But the seeds were definitely sown very early. I studied acting at the University of Windsor, and like a lot of bright-eyed lemmings, I trooped off to the big city. I got involved with the independent theater scene very early on, as it was a chance to actually do something other than grovel, which never really suited my temperament very well, which is a very, very bad character trait for an actor to have, by the way. I started writing almost by default. Somebody had to write something for my friends and I to be in, and I was nominated. I think I was out of the room at the time. It's usually the way it goes. Anyway, it went well enough that I kept at it. Never so well that we got out of the habit of creating our own projects. I think it's fair to say that the kind of projects I get excited about as a writer and a performer were never really the ones that excited the deliberately obscure and precious tastes of theater funding institutions. So, you know, we had to keep the do-it-yourself work ethic going. Ended up doing a lot of work with a few outfits that taught me a lot. Oddly enough, I learned a tremendous amount about keeping and holding an audience kind of in the old-school style, doing a never-ending series of murder mysteries that were full of vaudeville-type shtick. You know, they were ridiculous and in horrible performance venues, but there were a lot of really talented people in there, and I learned a lot from watching them and working with them. And I spent years working with a company that produced Shakespeare for high school audiences, which was fantastic and paid a lot of bills. But it was a real exercise in taking a story that might seem big and obscure and finding the truth of the story in it. A high school audience watching Shakespeare, they will cheer for you like you are a rock star, or they will turn on you like a pack of wild dogs, and it's up to you to decide which it's going to be. On the plus side, they tend to think the show is really happening, so there's an opportunity there to really reach them in a way that you never get from a very reserved, judgmental theater audience.
I then asked Greg how Decoder Ring Theater came about.
Well, Decoder Ring Theater just kind of evolved from the loose gang of actors I worked with in different configurations and companies. If I worked with you somewhere and I liked you, I would dragoon you into my own projects. The first thing we did was develop the original Red Panda miniseries, which is completely different from the current shows. We call them the alternate universe Red Panda. The biggest difference is they were very, very silly. We were recording them as a pilot for traditional radio broadcast, a completely unsolicited pilot, I might add. It was very naive, but it was something I had wanted to try for years and years, you know, ever since those old Sunday night broadcasts. It was something I really wanted to work with and play with. And this, I think, was 1999, so before digital techniques made recording and creating your own shows cheap and easy. so they were neither. They cost a small pile of money we really didn't have, and then they mostly sat in a drawer as I tried to get them some play. meanwhile, we went back to the theater, but we kept the name for a lot of new projects, including the original form of Blackjack Justice, our detective series. Originally, it was a play. It was a one-act farce about a very bad day in the life of an old-time detective show that was also called Blackjack Justice. Anyway, that did very well in its own way, and we had some other success, and eventually we put up a website and stuck the original Red Panda miniseries up as MP3 downloads, you know, just to get them out into the world. I really have to give a shout-out there to my friend Alan, who had introduced me to the wide world of radio shows on MP3 by giving me about 1,000 hours worth of shows for my birthday one year. Really, now that I think about it, it was a present that changed my life in 100 ways. And so we put the shows up, and we started getting email from all over the world, really. People had found the shows, and they wanted more, and it finally seemed possible to really get them out to an audience. And the more I looked into new recording technologies and controlling the distribution yourself with podcasting, it finally seemed possible to sustain a project like this, have it grow, and both in terms of the content and the characters and the stories and the audience, have it really find its way in the world and reach its audience.
Greg then talked about how advances in recording technology and media distribution have helped Decoder Ring Theater evolve.
The changes in technology have been everything. Everything. There's an audience for shows in this style, for full cast audio. There's a big one, and often a rabid one. But it's not one that's all concentrated in one place. You'd never get them to come and sit in the same room while we do shows for them. I mean, seems a little silly, really. I mean, it is how I used to spend all my time, but still. And even with traditional broadcast media, it's just so fragmented these days. And that's bad if you are an old-school traditional broadcaster and you're used to a certain revenue stream. But if you are someone who was not in every way serviced by that, this is some treacle that everyone will kind of like and no one will love, sort of broadcasting. The infinite choice available now is so fantastic. The days are gone when you can listen to, you can tune in Jack Benny and be reasonably sure that you're sharing that experience with most Americans. They're gone, and they're not coming back. These days, people need entertainment on their own terms, and it's now possible to bring them that. You know, I walk to work every day. People commute. They have a spare half hour at their desk in the middle of the day. They have errands to run after work. Fantastic. We want to tell you a story.
Obviously, Greg is a huge fan of old-time radio shows. I asked him what some of his favorites were.
There are so many. I'm still discovering more all the time. A lot of the earliest surviving recordings from the Great Radio Era are from around 1932, and it's generally considered to have ended in 62 with the cancellation of Suspense and Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. So that's, yeah, and that was a little display of geek bravado on my part. Sorry about that. So that's 30 years of popular entertainment to choose from. You know, it was a period of massive invention. There was no such thing as a series then. Every single genre that we use today, the sitcom, the detective show, the adventure show, the police procedural, the game show, the talk show, everything was invented for radio. If I had to play favorites, you know, the ones that I keep coming back to, The Shadow, of course, particularly the early episodes when the writing was much better. And I love Orson. I really do. God help me, I bet I do. The adventure serials, Captain Midnight and Superman, of course. Bud Collier. Now, there was a Superman you could set your watch to. the suspense was like 20 years of big stars and a brilliant anthology series. Jack Benny, The Hornet. I got really into Gunsmoke about 2 years ago, and I listened to about 200 episodes in a row, and I started to go a little squirrely. I was just talking like Chester Proudfoot all the time. A Six Shooter with Jimmy Stewart. Man, that one is a gem. Some beautiful, beautiful writing in there, just a short run. Really, you know, there is so much talent and technique on display, and there's so many shows available on MP3, you know, really lovingly preserved by folks. You can immerse yourself in the shows, and in so doing, you have an opportunity to create shows within that element rather than just a copy or a parody, which is really always our goal.
The Red Panda, described by Dakota Ring Theatre as Canada's greatest superhero, is influenced by many famous characters from the days of old-time radio and pulp magazines. Greg talked about the sources of inspiration that went into creating the Red Panda and explained how he came up with the name.
The Red Panda was inspired by, oh boy, a number of different versions of Batman. Golden Age, Silver Age, Adam West, for sure. Absolutely. You can hear it in the cadences, sometimes in the voice. It's Orson Welles meets Adam West, and they go for a drink. The Shadow, both the radio Shadow and the pulp magazine Shadow. They're very, very different, but there certainly are. There's elements of both of them in there. The Spider, Doc Savage, the Green Hornet. The Spirit is a big influence. It seems a little arrogant to even say that. I mean, we sort of canonized Will Eisner, and why not? Why not? But no, there's a mystery man for you. Growing up, I was convinced that the Super Friends was a serious drama. I mean, you didn't talk in my house when the Super Friends were on because I would never be able to catch up with this intricate plot. there's a whole range of masked men in the old school. Some of them are dark and some of them are light, and they share a drive and ability that border on the genuinely superhuman, and a profound sense of decency and justice. And you gotta have a good sidekick so you have someone to talk to. Actually, the name, Red Panda, came from a really bad sunburn I once got while wearing a pair of wraparound sunglasses that were fashionable at some point, I'm sure. I was bright red with a pasty white domino mask that I couldn't take off, which of course looks like the small raccoon-like animal, which is called a red panda. And then I started clowning, and he just kind of evolved from there, in skits and sketches and very annoying outgoing messages left on my answering machine. It took a number of years for him to develop into the character as he appears in the Red Panda Adventures, but he's a determined guy.
Dakota Ring Theatre's other show, Blackjack Justice, also has its share of influences.
Of all the detective writers in that hard-boiled school, my favorite to read is Chandler, Raymond Chandler. There's so much poetry and loss and longing all pushed down beneath this cynical surface, and I really do love the Philip Marlowe radio shows, even though Chandler had nothing to do with them beyond presumably cashing a check. Gerald Moore as Marlowe, who's really everything a private eye should be. Also, Sam Spade, I love that show. There's a bit of a change in attitude for Jack between our first season of shows, our first 12 shows, and the shows that are running now, which I attribute to having listened to a lot of a show called Richard Diamond and a lot of the Nero Wolfe radio show. Just before I wrote these new episodes, I was writing, and you know, Jack just started coming on to all the female clients very overtly, and I'm like, you've been spending too much time with Archie Goodwin. Trixie Dixon, of course, stands high on the shoulders of Candy Matson, who was the original girl detective.
Listening to the shows produced by Decoder Ring Theatre It is obvious a lot of care and time go into them. I ask Greg how long it takes for a typical show to go from first word on the page to finished production.
Well, let's see. It varies wildly, but I do write fast. You have to, or you won't get it done. It does help to know the characters as well as you get to after a few scripts. I think that writing for recurring characters is easier in that way. Usually when I'm writing a script, it takes about a week. I don't have a good guess in hours. If it's coming very easily, if I get X number of pages done in a day, I stop. And if I'm not, I keep at it as much as I can within the confines of the rest of my life. I don't really have a good guess in hours. Probably anywhere from 12 to 20, I guess, to finish the script. If it's less, if I have less on my plate and I can just sit and write. I think the record is about 6 hours, but I was on holiday. The average is much higher than that. Then we read through the script and we bang the dents out of it. And sometimes that's very easy and sometimes it's very hard. And we divvy up the roles. I send out scripts and the role offers to our mob with email. And we schedule our sessions and then we record. The recordings we usually do on weekend morning sessions, and we'll do 2 episodes in a day. So each one takes maybe 2.5 hours with a cast of anywhere from 4 to 8 or 9 tops. And then I edit the raw tracks and assemble the episode. That's 2 to 4 evenings of work. It's probably somewhere around 38, 39 man hours involved in creating each show. That's really kind of fuzzy bad math. It sounds about right. Now, that doesn't include the work of actually running the podcast or promotions or what have you. But it really doesn't pay to add those numbers up. They just make you tired thinking about them, you know. It's a lot of work, but there's real joy in creating these shows and having fun together and reaching our audience with them. And the response of the audience is fantastic. It has really enriched our lives a lot in absolutely every non-financial way.
Greg then talked about the growing number of audio programs being produced and distributed via the internet.
You know, there are a lot of new audio drama works out there being created. They all have different styles and takes. There is no really solid marketing guy argument for sticking to the old-time style beyond the fact that it's the shows I wanted to create. That's the joy of listening to all these different new shows. Every one of them is born out of someone's passion and love for the story and really making something just the way they would want to hear it. And it reaches your ears without ever having the fun sucked out of it by a committee. If folks actually look on our podcast page, you go to www.decoderringtheater.com and you look down the sidebar. There's a ton of links to different groups that are all creating new audio works in their own style. Some are podcasts, some produce them live, some produce them for CD. Some of them I love, some of them aren't my cup of tea, but they're definitely all worth a spin. I've been really pleased and proud to help one or two newer ones find their feet a little since we got going. And we get email out there from folks that are working on their own and asking for advice and things, and it's fantastic. It's just fantastic to see it growing and evolving, and I don't know what it's going to be, and anyone who tries to tell you they know what it's going to be is a fraud or a liar, but I really do look forward to finding out.
Finally, I ask Greg what the future holds for Decoder Ring Theater.
Oh, the future. More the same, I hope. I hope folks keep listening and telling their friends with that glorious evangelical zeal that folks bring to the things they find on the net. It really has been a joy to us. And I think we'll keep doing it as long as we can, as long as people keep tuning in, as long as the demand is there and is growing. It certainly has meant a tremendous amount to us and I think to others too, which is fantastic. It's fantastic.
I would like to thank Greg Taylor once again for doing that interview for us. I've recently found out through Decoder Ring Theater's MySpace blog that he has been especially busy lately. He's been writing furiously, and the troupe has been recording episodes the last few weekends, trying to get as many in the can as possible. I think they have enough to take him through late 2008 at this point, but the reason why he's doing that is because Greg and his wife Clarissa, who plays Kit Baxter, a.k.a. the Flying Squirrel, in the Red Panda Adventures, are expecting their first child. So congratulations to Greg and Clarissa. Considering their child will have the combined DNA of the Red Panda and Flying Squirrel, criminals in the Toronto area better watch out.
Well, we're just about the end of another Technology and the Arts podcast. Before we go, I just want to remind our listeners that if you have any news, ideas, events, or anything else related to technology and the arts, let us know at technology.arts@gmail.com. We have a brand new events calendar up on the blog, and we want to fill it up.
Well, that closes the curtain on another Technology and the Arts podcast. Again, thanks to Decoder Ring Theater's Greg Taylor for talking to us. Next time out, we'll hear from singer-songwriter and Jersey Shore music fixture, Christian Beach, who after years of using technology heavily in his music, is preparing to put out his first acoustic CD. But he hasn't completely abandoned technology. Again, we'll be talking to singer-songwriter Christian Beach in our next podcast, which will be posted at techarts.wordpress.com on Wednesday, March 21st, 2007. So until then, for Technology and the Arts, this is Brian Kelly.
And this is John Lemazny. Take care.
For more information about the podcast you have just heard, please visit Technology and the Arts on the web at techarts.wordpress.com.